I will call the meeting to order, and today is just an informational hearing. We're not going to take any votes or anything, but we can certainly ask questions, and my intent is to just try to educate some of the members of my committee about the problems we have in the healthcare system in terms of the kind of people we're training, and are we training enough, and so on. I know the MMA has a committee that's looking at this, and they feel that in 10 years we'll be 1,000 primary care docs short of what we need, and also short another 1,000 of other kinds of docs. So, and it's a the way the healthcare system is changing. There's more emphasis on primary care, and so that's why we're having this hearing. I don't think we're going to do much this year to fix the problem, but we may set up a committee. I'm talking to people in the Senate and to do something during the interim so that we can start to address this problem. Because if you just look at the physician part of it, it's 4 years of medical school, and if they're in primary care, it's a 3-year residency program, so that's 7 years. So it will take a time. And Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, I just would volunteer to be on that committee. Since I'm never picked, I thought I'd step forward.
So, yeah, and I've talked to, I've talked to Pulaski, and who's head of higher ed. It's sort of a mixture of higher ed and the health care committee, and this Senate is also very interesting.
I'll volunteer in that committee.
So, we're going to start out with Mark Schoenbaum from the Department of Health that has, he's in charge, actually, of part of the rural health system and for the Department of Health and for primary care. So, Mark, if you want to make start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Schoenbaum, again, from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care at the Health Department. I will try and set the stage for the speakers that are going to follow this morning. Really appreciate the invitation. Mr. Chair, you made, I think, most of the central points already about primary care and about the workforce situation, so I will try and breeze through if the machine will work here. There we go. So why focus on healthcare? Obviously, we need sufficient numbers of healthcare workers to provide the care that the populace demands. That's old news. Something that we are seeing more and more is the recognition that in order to meet our broader health system transformation goals for improving quality, reducing cost, improving the population's experience, paying attention to the healthcare workforce is a central component of being able to achieve these goals. You'll see on the slide in front of you that the one of the recent task forces, the Governor's Health Reform Task Force from 2012, acknowledged this connection by including workforce explicitly in their health reform roadmap. Healthcare is also a major economic sector, and you have a handout, I think yours may be in black and white, that shows what a major sector of employment healthcare is in our state's economy, and it is continued to be projected to grow at a faster pace than the rest of employment in Minnesota. Today we're going to be focusing on the central primary care occupations, but if you turn to the back, and this is for projection purposes, but just look down the left-hand column and you can see the breadth of occupations and professions that make up the healthcare sector, and they range all the way from paraprofessionals and certificate workers obviously central to everything from home care to long-term care to technical occupations, primary care, and specialties. Again, today is about primary care, but let's, I think, just put that in this broader context. How can we think about, Chairman Huntley mentioned that there are shortages expected. How can we think about this and what's driving that? This graphic is one way to start to wrap our arms around that. If you look at the red line on the screen, that's our projection of the demand for services, driven in large part by the aging of the boomer section of the population. It's going up very rapidly. Similarly, if you look at the blue line at the bottom of the graph, the healthcare workforce, and these are the central primary care occupations, is also has that boomer demographic shape, and they're going to be leaving the field at an accelerated rate. So we've got a problem. The yellow line in the middle tells us that our educational institutions are not going to be able to ramp up their production of graduates at a sufficient rate to respond to these changes. Health reform, the green line at the very top, will create some more demand as people get coverage and start to use more care. So we've accounted for that. Given the underlying dynamic of this phenomenon, the health reform effect is one that has an incremental effect on this long-term trend. So how big a shortage is there going to be?
Just interrupt. Representative Norton has a question for you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the back, you referenced the handout that you have on the back, and I'm getting a little distressed, and so I'm sure you can alleviate that distress quickly, but it appears that we have surgeons that only have a high school diploma, or some that have some college and no degree, and we have some with an associate's degree, and that's true in a lot of those professionals. So could you help clarify that for me?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, this is a projection out of Georgetown University, and it uses the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics categorization. So it's not my work, and so I can't necessarily clarify all that. I'll be happy to go back and dig into the details. I presented it today just to show you again, to kind of remind us of the range of occupations, how all these counts were made. I'll have to investigate for you, Representative Norton.
Okay, thank you.
The Representative Abler has a question.
Well, thanks. Just then, while you have that chart up there, nice to see you again. You got set up real well, looks like. So, but that little green line above the baseline related to health reform, it actually, just what I've read about it is like there's this huge demand going to arrive because of health reform. It looks like it's just incremental. Has it been overstated, the new providers will need because of health reform? It looks to me like that's not any end-of-the-world number there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I think the answer to the question is kind of all in your starting point. You know, if you look just at that health reform effect, it is notable and will be a strain on the system. But you can't look at any of these trends in isolation. We have a big problem with or without health reform, and health reform makes it some worse. But if we just address the health reform part of this, we're not going to solve the big picture situation we're in.
Okay, thank you. I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Go ahead.
So to the numbers.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I appreciate your comment that health care reform can make things worse, because I completely agree with that statement. Which may come as a surprise to both members of the committee. But, you know, it was recently just reported in the national news the fourth Georgia hospital closed due to Obamacare payments cuts. So the reduction in payments under the Affordable Care Act is going to aggravate the whole system, especially when you put 7 years of education or 8 years or whatever, pile up hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, and then you go out into the medical field and you receive underpayments versus your expenses from government reimbursement guidelines. Any response to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not really. I think that's somewhat outside of the kind of the scope of just the strict workforce issues. I mean, the aspects of getting an education, seeking employment, dealing with the debt burden, you know, have been with us and will continue to be with us. We will need more workers as people secure care under health reform. So that's
one follow-up. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up comment. The point is this. Why would I go through 7 years of education, 8 years, pile up thousands of dollars of debt to go into a profession that underpays me to cover my expenses and repay my loans? It's a disincentive, and there's plenty of predictions out there that we're going to see fewer people go into the medical professions, not more, because of the reforms under the ACA.
So, Representative Grunhagen, you're suggesting that we spend more money, federal money, on health care?
Mr. Chair, I'm suggesting that rather than spend billions of dollars on government bureaucracy to micromanage the doctor-patient relationship through MNsure and the ACA, 159 new boards and bureaucracies at the federal level, instead that money would be better directed towards the hospital doctor-patient relationship in terms of increasing reimbursement, not growing bloated government bureaucracy.
Hagen, then you're telling me that the system we have is great and we shouldn't have any changes.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not telling you that. I have a set of reforms which I'll be glad to share with the committee at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Mr. Schoenbach, continue.
Thank you. I'll jump ahead a moment here to perhaps a little bit of Representative Grunhagen's point. Having the right people where we need them, doing the right things, is a complex process. And this chart here, which we call the Workforce Development Pipeline, is one way to think about all the steps involved. And attention needs to be paid at each of these steps in order to have success ultimately. So we need to prepare kids in math and science and interest them in health occupations. We need to recruit them into health professions, education, and training, both traditional students and non-traditional students, so that they match the demographics of the population. We need to locate training programs and have sufficient training programs in areas where students are going to get exposed to the work situation and the needs of the future. Once they graduate, they're still going to have all kinds of choices. They do take their debt loads and income possibilities into consideration. So we need to have incentives to encourage them to locate where they're needed most. And we need to pay attention to what that workplace is going to look like, and once people are in place, we need to make sure that they're retained over the long term. So it is a complex picture. And back to the shortage. There's no agreement on what the precise number is. Here are some a variety of predictions about what we're going to be facing in Minnesota when it comes to physicians. As you'll see, there's a certain amount of variation. I won't linger on this. The one thing that stands out for me is that no one is predicting a surplus. Moving on to today's topic, primary care. I think Representative Huntley has already talked about why this is of central importance. At the Health Department, we did a recent report that takes a look at our primary care workforce. Looking at these central occupations, you can see that physicians still predominate, although nurse practitioners and physician assistants make up a significant share of the primary care workforce as well, and you'll hear more about that from the following speakers. What do we know about the demographics of that workforce? This is a busy slide, in short, their gender varies, with physician assistants actually being surprisingly female-dominated over time from their origins as military medics. They have different age profiles, with physicians and nurse practitioners. Again, picking up that boomer profile, physician assistants being a younger occupation. Ethnically and racially, they still do not mirror the population at large. And we also ask them at the health department, how long do you continue to work? If you look at that bottom graphic there, you can see that in each occupation, even significantly in physician assistants, many of them are planning to leave the field within the next 10 years.
If I could just interrupt, Representative Kwan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And even putting my glasses on and looking at this and there, the font is challenging, and I was wondering if it's possible to get this presentation and the others in a soft copy so I can blow up and actually read and look at the data.
Representative Kwan, I was thinking of the same thing, and I was up there, I was thinking I'm nearsighted, and I'm farsighted, so there's a ophthalmologist shortage.
We'll try to get these blown up and passed out. And I agree with you, and I just had cataract surgery last summer.
Here's a bigger graphic for you, and I know it's of interest to the committee, and that's the geographic distribution of our primary care workforce. I think of note is that the share of the primary care workforce in our small and isolated rural areas is below the share of the population of the state that lives in those areas. So we do have some maldistribution geographically.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Can you tell me what would the chart look like if you looked back into, say, 1960 or 1970? How much has this changed? It seems to be a pretty drastic change, but maybe not.
John Bonner.
Or maybe you don't know. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, I really don't know. I'll look. Something we do know is that family medicine has always been the backbone of the rural health system. And there was a generation of pioneers working all the time to keep the rural health system going. And many of them have already left practice. More will be leaving. I think there's trouble, could be trouble ahead here.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I just, I look back, I grew up in Nebraska. And in rural Nebraska, there were a lot of towns. There were a lot of financial incentives post-Vietnam for medics to go to medical school, and then they were placed in those smaller communities, and they stayed there, many of them, but they were not replaced then after that generation moved on. So, I just suspect we've seen a change in that, and again, as you pointed out, part of it is the difference between specialties and family care, and I think, frankly, the cost of medical and specialty, education plays a role in folks deciding to go into a more lucrative practice because they do have a lot of debt to pay off. But thank you.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know in the previous years we did community paramedic and other things to allow more of a broader team just in the scope who can work under physician's orders, etc. Are we anticipating seeing some bills that would allow other members of the team, since we're having a decrease in the availability of physicians as a whole, and the charts indicating in the rural areas, or it's even more acute. Do we anticipate seeing some bills to try and address that, to allow other members of the team, other than physicians, to provide services like we have?
Well, there certainly is an effort to, with the health care reform that's going on, with or without the Affordable Care Act, to try to get all the providers working at the top of their scope of practice rather than doing things that they're overtrained for. And so that is one of the efforts, and there are certainly scope practice issues coming up. There will be bills on physician assistants. There's bills on nurse practitioners. but we're going to have to move on so we can get through all the people we've got here to testify. So, Representative Abler.
Well, just briefly, I just was noticing the chart I could actually read. With the last chart, it showed, I would have expected more nurse practitioners and PAs to be out in the outstate part, and actually there is a lower proportion of them than the family docs almost, and that was, I just was surprised about that. It seems, because I always thought they were filling the gap, especially outstate, and apparently they're actually not. So I was just, and they all suck to the urban core, so it's interesting. I mean, they're drawn to the urban core.
Representative Grunenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. You know, I just want to bring up the point that, you know, this is a time when we're struggling to have enough providers out there, at a time when the need for health care is going to grow exponentially with the retiring of the baby boomers getting into the years of aging where they're probably going to need more health care. So we have two lines going, you know, completely opposite. So I'd say the problem is going to get much worse if we don't come up with a solution rather than better.
Mr. Schoenbach.
To that point, we've taken a look at kind of all the links in the pipeline that it takes to start with a kid and get turn them into a healthcare provider. What are we doing as a state to invest in that process and try and grow the number of providers? Here's a chart, much too small to read. You also do have this one as a handout, which perhaps you can spend some time with it later, that shows the variety of state activities intended to support each step in that workforce development pipeline, from summer intern programs to activities by our higher education systems, to the MERC program that you are all familiar with, to the state loan forgiveness program, scope of practice changes, and other approaches to team care were already mentioned. So spend some time with that. At the bottom of this chart, given that more is needed, you've got some thoughts on future options to consider. Many of these come from the recommendations of the 2012 Governor's Reform Task Force. You took action on MERC last year. Many of these recommendations remain for future consideration. So let me know if you have any questions on any of these, perhaps at a later date, so I can keep moving here. Here is an example of what we do through loan forgiveness and related programs at the state level. It makes a small but important difference. The change that you made in MERC last year, raising that to $58 million, adding a primary care residency support grant program for Greater Minnesota programs also makes a difference. We've asked the MERC training sites what their total expenses are through another change that you made last year, and the recent tally came in at $345 million. So the state is now contributing 58 of that. The federal government through Medicare is contributing about 180. So there's the VA and some other contributors as well. So there's still a gap between those clinical training costs and support to keep them going. We need to be the best fishermen we can be, to use a Minnesota analogy, and we need to do kind of everything we can to capture all of the workers possible and get them into the healthcare system, but there aren't enough people, there aren't enough fish in the lake. So we cannot, even after all this, probably train our way out of it. We need to look at practice redesign through the healthcare home program and other approaches. Scope of practice can make a difference. Emerging professions can also make a difference. And I think Minnesota probably leads the nation in having official state government recognition and reimbursement for this list of emerging professions. Other states are looking to us. Community health workers, dental therapists, community paramedics, and doulas, you have all taken action to support, and they will make a difference over the long term. some thoughts on what it takes for success with those new professions and scope of practice. And just to close, I think you've heard about this major federal grant, the State Innovation Model grant that has come to the Departments of Health and Human Services. Kind of back to my opening theme, this is another endeavor where we are seeing attention to workforce issues built into achieving some broader health reform goals, and it's the kind of thing that we're going to need to look for more in the future.
Yes.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just I see we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 five testifiers, and there's no testifier. I was wondering if we're going to talk about residencies and numbers of slots and that kind of thing. Is that for today or is that for another time?
We'll get that if you look at, turn your page over.
Oh, here we go. Okay.
That's he will be testifying about graduate medical education, which is,
that's
to my way of thinking, is one of the big bottlenecks that we have.
Yep, that's my question.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Mary Chesney is next. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Chesney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members. Sit on the bottom. Want a slide or view? Thanks. Let's switch this. Oops. Thank you. It's right. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Chesney, and I am the clinical associate professor at the University of Minnesota, where I direct the Doctor of Nursing Practice program, and it's the program at the university where we educate all four roles of advanced practice registered nurses.
Could you get that microphone? Yeah.
I'll move.
Or move over a little bit. There you go.
All right. Would you like me to repeat that?
No, that's
okay.
Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I'd just start off with a little bit of a national view. I'm trying to keep the my remarks brief because I know you have a lot of people to hear today, but just to give you a feel for the national view. When we think of primary care advanced practice registered nurses, we really are primarily focusing on four population focus areas for nurse practitioners, and then also nurse midwives should be considered primary care providers, and they are by CMS and in the Affordable Care Act as well, because many women who really have a good relationship with their nurse midwife do go to them for primary care services from the time they're contemplating a conception all the way through menopausal years. So they are providing primary care as well. On certified nurse midwives, the current number in the United States is 13,071. You can see the number for certified nurse practitioners, and this is based on 2014 data. In order to give you some information about the primary care nurse practitioners, however, I needed to go to 2010 data. It's the best that I can find on AHRQ. And back then, when they were looking at 106,073 nurse practitioners, of those, 55,625, or 52%, end up practicing in areas of primary care. Similar to trends in PAs and in the physician world, we find that some nurse practitioners are choosing to work with specialty physicians to focus on specialty care. We also need to just point out that there are programs not here in Minnesota, but in other parts of the United States that also prepare nurse practitioners for a more of an acute care role, such as a neonatal nurse practitioner. So that's why you're seeing that difference in the numbers. According to the Bureau of Health Professional data, in a 2013, or in a report that they put out in 2013, the primary care nurse practitioner supply is projected to increase by about 30% over the next 10 years, with the idea that we'll move from the numbers you see on the screen, 55,400 primary care nurse practitioners in 2010, to about 72,100 in 2020. Now, there have been others, particularly David Auerbach, who's with RAND Corporation, that have looked more at a regression analysis using age cohorts, and his numbers are projected to be a little bit higher. So I think he's projecting more in 20, I'm trying to find my numbers here, I'm sorry, of 122,000 in over the next 10 years, and also has made the comment that he expects that the tremendous growth in students going into nurse practitioner programs will actually offset some of the retirement data that you'll see here, projected retirement. As far as Minnesota, currently, and this is with Board of Nursing data obtained yesterday, we have a little over 6,000 advanced practice registered nurses in Minnesota. You can see the breakdown by the four different categories. Again, as we look at primary care workforce today, we really need to be focusing on the nurse midwife number of 272 in Minnesota and nurse practitioners at about 3,755. We do not have a breakdown the way the Board of Nursing collects its data currently. We do not have a breakdown in terms of trying to differentiate those nurse practitioners who are in primary care settings versus those who are in acute care. And so you're going to see in some subsequent slides that I'm going to be using some 2011-2012 Minnesota Department of Health data, because they did break down and looked at the primary care workforce. So again, nurse midwives at about 272. You can see on the slide that when you think about nurse practitioners who can provide primary care, we really are talking about adult family nurse practitioners, gerontology, pediatric, and women's health. It's important to note that nurse practitioner education nationally continues to evolve. And just within the last several years, programs have begun to combine adult gerontology. So students are focusing on both those areas. Part of the reason for that, it's very difficult to figure out where someone kind of crosses the line and kind of needing more of a geriatric focus. Also, when you look at the typical internal medicine kind of clinic, you have persons really in the more of the adult population and geriatric population coming into those practices. So it did not seem very practical, nor meeting the needs of patients, to be separating out adult from gerontology. So that's all combined now as one specialty area. And so I think as we start to see data out of HRSA and others, we'll start to see that differentiated differently than you see on the slide currently. In terms of looking at nurse practitioners in the primary care workforce by their different population focus, the largest area is family nurse practitioner. It is by far the fastest growing in Minnesota, and you'll see that in a short while as we look at the educational programs. Adult, about 19%. Pediatrics is the next highest with 15%, and then 9% in each of the areas of women's health and in gerontological nurse practitioners. And again, this is all based on 2011-12 data from our Minnesota Department of Health. When we look specifically at some of the demographics, you can see that primarily primary care nurse practitioners, it's primarily a women's profession right now. We would like to see more men enter the field, but currently only 5% of primary care nurse practitioners are male. I believe that we'll see some increase in that as we look at the demographics for people who are entering registered nurse programs in Minnesota. Certainly the numbers of males are up in many programs around 10-11%. So I would look for that trend to change in time. If you look at the age distribution, you can see that we do have the largest group there is the group that will retire within the next 10 years. But again, I would say some of the health economists on the national scene are looking more at an age cohort regression modeling and still believe that the number of new people going into the field will help to offset, at least, so that we shouldn't be going down in number as we have a large group leaving the workforce within the next 10 years. It's also important to note in the data that Mr. Schoenbaum's group at Minnesota Department of Health looked at in 2011-2012, they did ask the question about how likely are people to leave Minnesota for practice. And what we do find in the question for nurse practitioners, how many plan to leave within 6 years or less, it is concerning to me that the younger group mentioned that they were 19% plan to leave the state, and that was larger than the other groups other than those who plan to retire. And I can't speculate. I don't have data or evidence to support that. I have some anecdotal thoughts and from some preliminary data coming out of Colorado for why that might be so. But that concerns me, that our younger people that we are educating, that a higher percentage are planning to leave our state. And I think it warrants some investigation. As we look at geographic distribution, as Mr. Schoenbaum talked about, we do have more of a cluster of our primary care nurse practitioners in the urban setting. I would also tell you I don't have nurse midwives on this because I don't have the breakdown. Mr. Schoenbaum's work at the Minnesota Department of Health looked at just nurse practitioners in primary care. We do know, though, that a majority of nurse midwives as well tend to be in the urban areas. There have been difficulties with some wanting to create or start practices in the north, not being able to find collaborating physicians, wanting to have them come in as competition. So that's been a concern. So most are clustered in the I'd say 7-county metro area and in Rochester. As far as the percentage, you can see that only 79% of primary care nurse practitioners practice in the urban area, despite the fact that that's not where, only 70% of the population reside. You can look at the breakdown on the slides. Hopefully, can you all see it? I don't know if you want me to read that. I don't want to read slides to you if you can see the numbers, but if you can't, I'm willing to do so. I will say that one of the issues that comes up with regard to rural areas that we do hear from people is that when people set out on a career to become, for example, a family nurse practitioner, and they want to build a career, they want to move to a practice often where they're going to have a future, where they're going to be able to bring their family and be part of the community. There is a disincentive in Minnesota right now to go to the rural area, because if you're in a practice with a solo physician, the small town physician, if that person is older, nearing retirement, because of the need to have a collaborating agreement, prescriptive agreement, there isn't a security that one can stay in a clinic. So it provides a little less security for that person to drag their family to the rural area, decide that they'd like to set up their life there, and have the insecurity of not knowing, when you're not in a larger group practice, that you're always going to have a physician there with whom you can collaborate.
Representative Liebley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Chesney, I just really am interested in how you know that is a barrier, or how you know the extent to which that's a barrier. I mean, it's sort of intuitive when you say that, but so supposing that we remove that barrier, do you have any way of really knowing how much that would increase the rural access, or is that just kind of anecdotal?
Representative Liebling, I don't. And I will honestly tell you it is anecdotal. We haven't had a way to research it. We can ask people why they don't go. We know of clinics in outstate Minnesota that have closed down at times when their physician leaves town. I believe that Representative Schoen is someone who talked about his hometown and that the clinic is opened and closed like 3 different times. So I don't know. I would love to have the resources and the time to do a study, an exhaustive study of people as to why they choose to be where they are. I certainly wouldn't begin to even anecdotally or even in my opinion tell you that that's at the heart and soul of the only reason. I just raise it as a barrier that it is difficult to think about someone wanting to go to a clinic if you're going to go work for someone who's older, who could retire within the next 10 years, particularly with the difficulty that some smaller town clinics have in recruiting a physician. And I do find when we talk to our students that they really want to be somewhere where they can build a future. They'd like, you know, they're not looking to jump around. And if they're going to relocate anywhere, whether that's out of the state, out of the city, I think they're looking to build a future. And I do think it's a little riskier when one doesn't know if you're going to have someone with whom you can practice should that person decide to retire. But I totally admit I do not have research data, and I would not want to pretend that I do so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Mr. Schoenbaum talked about, one of the things that concerns us greatly in the APRN community and as an educational program is that we have, I think, horrendous statistics when we look at race and ethnicity within the primary care workforce. And in no way do we come anywhere close to representing what the face of Minnesota looks like today. And to that end, a number of the different programs in Minnesota, including at the University of Minnesota, we've been putting in multiple HRSA grants trying to specifically focus on, you know, what are the issues, how do we support students, how do we get students of color into our programs, how do we support them once they're there, what are the barriers, what are causing the problems. So it is something that we take very seriously, and we are trying diligently to look at that issue, but it's one that we are really struggling with in terms of creating an advanced practice workforce that mirrors our society.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I think one of the things we should look at, and I'd welcome your engagement in that, is the how do we promote people from within who are in the system? Because if you look at the Certified Nursing Assistant Program, which is a 12 or 16-week program, those are disproportionately, at least in the metro area, I think, people of color. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, working, creating career ladders for them to move up. Many times they work rotating shifts, you know, those sorts of things. So I think using, you know, online education with, you know, maybe, you know, flexible schedules on lab certifications and those sorts of things. I think we have the pipeline. They're already in the health industry. They've committed to the field and demonstrated those interests. But our educational programs don't really help. But that is one pipeline of people of various ethnic backgrounds that have, that at least in the metro, would be a potential source of recruits.
Continue, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I couldn't agree more. I will also say that in our efforts in terms of the work that we did to develop some grants and put in for grant funding from HRSA, we also are looking at the community college level and really trying to recruit students as well from nursing assistant programs, from community college, and really trying to look at what Minnesota needs to do to create a more seamless structure. There is work going on within Minnesota right now with the MAIN program. It's the a program that's focusing on community colleges across the state, and they're all working under one curriculum. And the students, when they enter the community college rate, which is an area for nurses where we tend to see more diversity, they are able to also simultaneously apply so that they will continue on with their education to get a baccalaureate degree. One of the difficulties in getting people to be able to come into a nurse practitioner program is they have to have a baccalaureate degree. It's a more rigorous entrance than an associate degree. And the problem is the diversity really, I would say, is better in the associate degree program. So we actually feel like we need to work with that program and work trying to partner with some of the associate degree programs as well to try to build relationships, to try to build ladders, to try to make things more seamless for them to process through the educational pipeline and not put so many barriers up in front of them. So I think you're absolutely right. We need to look at where is there diversity among those who have interest in nursing, and then how do we best recruit them, but not only recruit them, how do we support these students to help them to be successful?
Okay, please continue, and just to remind the members that we're about halfway, a little over halfway through the hearing. We have four more people to go, so.
Mr. Chair. Just to give you an overview of the primary care nurse practitioner programs in Minnesota, we currently have six who have family nurse practitioner programs, and you can see the list of schools on the slides. We have several who are preparing students in the adult gerontology area of specialty focus. This is going to be an increasingly important area as our Minnesota population continues to age. We have two pediatric nurse practitioner programs in the state and one women's health practitioner program. I tried to call all of my colleagues across the state when I received this request from Representative Huntley to present, just to try to see if I could at least get a handle on the academic year 2012-2013 data with regard to graduation rates. So you can see it on the slide. Oxford's program is brand new, and their first people will graduate several years from now. But you can see the numbers that were contributed. I apologize, St. Catharines in reporting their data. We did not get it segmented out in their different programs, but they do have an adult GERO program and a pediatric nurse practitioner program. But what we don't know is how many are in each of those groups. But they had 99. The asterisk you see on the table is because they had a curricular change, and therefore they had three cohorts of graduates when normally moving forward they will have two cohorts. So we have a little bit of an increased blip there. Normally they would produce somewhere in the area of about 60 graduates per year. In total, during 2012-13, we saw 256 graduates in primary care nurse practitioner programs and nurse midwifery in the Minnesota schools. Anticipated changes, I'll try to go quickly. The university just received an enormous grant. We are going to be able to fund 50 more students in their DMP program to become a primary care or one of our DMP areas of study. We estimate about 60 to 70% of these folks will focus in primary care APRN roles. So we anticipate that our numbers will increase at least probably in our pipeline per year, beginning about 3 years from now, by about another 30, 40 people. Augsburg program will begin to graduate their students in 2016, and Bethel is adding a new nurse midwifery program, and their first graduates, I believe, will graduate in 2015. Challenges, I'll go very quickly because I think you're going to hear a repeated story here as the testifiers come up. I think all of us are really struggling with the increase in competition for clinical sites. It's a very, very tight market in the Twin City area. We find a tight market even in Rochester area as well. And difficult, too, for our students who are outstate who might want to stay near their home for their practice site or clinical site to find clinical site areas. Some of the things that contribute to the shortages, you know, we haven't moved enough down the track on outcome-based payment models yet, and so all of the primary care providers are struggling to generate revenue based on our old RVU generation system. And what happens is with the change that happened in the last number of years with CMS, where medical students, PAs, and nurse practitioner students, and nurse midwifery students have to be so closely supervised as to have the preceptor either in the room the entire time that they're doing the history of the exam, or the preceptor has to go in and repeat the entire exam, it really slows them down. And we used to have students in clinic sometimes primary care site for a year, and you'd be with them the entire time the first semester, but by the second and the third, you started seeing them get better and better. And you used to be able to have them do the history, do an exam, you'd go in, you'd repeat pertinent parts of the history, you'd do the pertinent parts of the exam, and then talk about the assessment plan of the student. And I think you're going to hear from my PA and med school colleagues as well that all of these things have contributed to really causing people to say, we just can't slow down to be able to have students, and all of us are facing very similar issues in the clinical area. And we do try to place our students so they have some time with physicians. We also want them to have role modeling by advanced practice registered nurses in their specific role, and we find that it is hard to have our APRN preceptors in some of the areas of greater Minnesota, so that's a difficulty as well. I will also say that one of the things, again, that I think we need to keep our eye on is that we create a practice environment in Minnesota that encourages our best and our brightest to stay here. And I won't go into a big commentary, but simply to note that in a map put together by the AARP and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Minnesota is in the lowest third as having a very restrictive practice environment, and so that is a concern to me in terms of keeping our students here once we've educated them. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Dr. Chesney, and I'm glad you brought up right at the end about the training sites. That's a huge problem for everything, because it slows down the physicians that are monitoring these people, and a lot of them can't afford to slow down. So any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Chesney, that training site thing, I think, is a huge problem, not just, of course, for nurse practitioners, but for everybody, and a big bottleneck, I think. And, you know, I haven't, other than to say we should change that the payment thing and what you described is kind of counterproductive for that, which we don't have a ton of control over that. Is there any, you know, I mean, I don't want to take too much time on this, but I just would really love it if somebody had a creative solution to that problem, you know, even if there was another way to fund that training, mm-hmm. you know, something, because it's going to continue to be a big problem.
Yes. Dr. Chesney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I agree with you. I think it's something that really all three groups need to sit down and look at. We're all competing for the same sites, number one. I think, secondly, I know that medical school colleagues are still struggling despite the fact that there is GME money to help offset costs at sites. We have to remember that when you look at PA and nurse practitioner students, you know, we don't. The graduate nursing education was a pilot in the Affordable Care Act, and only five schools in the nation were awarded this pilot. But right now, we do not pay our preceptor sites. That would be that would make our tuition so astronomical as to not make it feasible for students if we had to pay all of our preceptor sites. So really, we ask, and I believe the PAs do as well, we ask people to precept our students for whatever little bit of MRC money they obtain. But otherwise, it is out of the goodness of their hearts, and it's out of their desire to educate the next generation. And so I do think funding is an issue. If we can't offset preceptors' loss of revenue when they have to slow down to educate students, if we can't offset that in some way, there isn't much incentive there for them to do it except out of the goodness of your heart. And as the sites get tighter and people are asked to do it over and over again, I'm very concerned, as I'm sure you'll hear from my colleagues as well who talk after, but it's a problem.
Thank you, Dr. Chesney. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next we'll go on to Heather Biedinger. Biedinger. Whichever. Welcome to the committee. And would you state your name for them?
Chairman Huntley, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation. My name is Heather Biedinger. I am representing the Minnesota Association of PAs as well as on behalf of the other PA program directors. And I thank you for the invitation to speak on primary care. I am a PA, and so I speak from an administrative perspective, but I've also practiced in rural Minnesota in an isolated setting, so I also understand this from a practice setting. In the interest of time, I think I'll go through quickly some of the other things that have already been discussed, except for some places where I think it's important to reinforce concerns and barriers. But just to start off, PAs are licensed medical providers that take care for patients, do histories, do physical exams, order and interpret laboratory and diagnostic studies, create care plans, certify health status. In the accountable care organizations, PAs can handle a panel of patients. We haven't seen that rise to the utilization of PAs in Minnesota quite yet, but they are capable of doing that. A quick overview on the PA education. It is a graduate level medical education, usually between 26 and 30 months, depending on the program, and split very much like medical school, where half of it is didactic classroom courses, and the other half is in clinical rotations among a various amount of specialty. The goal, however, is primary care practice, preparing PAs to be generalist providers, but giving them the opportunity to do primary care, internal medicine, women's health, peds, internal medicine, and specialty practice. I know we've already heard some data on PA practice, but the recent data for PAs in Minnesota is 1,565 licensed PAs. The recent MDH data does show that they count all the PAs in Minnesota as being in primary care, although our national data pulls from the Minnesota perspective, and at that time thought that at least 39% were in true primary care areas. We do see that 20% of these are in the large, small, and isolated rural areas. We do expect the demographics to change a little bit because we are right in the new changing of increasing programs, and I think I'm going to skip to that and then share some of that data with you. Up until 2012, for 15 years, there was one PA program in Minnesota at Augsburg, and their mission really was for primary care and rural practice, as it still is. In 2012, St. Catherine University started a PA program, and then Bethel followed in 2013, and St. Scholastica is on the books for their accreditation in 2016. So very quickly, we moved from one to four programs in Minnesota. So if you'd asked what a barrier to increasing workforce from the PA perspective 10 years ago, it might be access to education programs, but that is really no longer the case. We also have to recognize that these programs are here to provide primary primary care PAs. And I think we have to commend the foresight of the education institutions who started pursuing these programs 2007, 2008, and beyond. The other thing that we're aware of workforce data really critically is because our accreditation agency requires that we do pretty specific needs assessment studies to demonstrate that a need for a PA program in this state was necessary and that clinical rotation and education opportunities existed to be able to meet the needs of the learners. So I'm going to go a little bit to the barriers as well and some of the solutions that we've seen. And starting with the education component, and I want to hit on clinical education, as Dr. Chesney has already alluded to, but I'm going to start with a couple other things. One, Minnesota's programs are limited to expansion because most of them are new. There are restrictions on accrediting rules that allow or don't allow new programs to expand beyond what they first start out with. So right now, at the end of December, you can expect to have about 54 graduates out of Minnesota for new programs. But in 2 years, we will see that rise to over 90 new graduates that graduate from Minnesota programs. And with the onboarding of Scholastica, that could rise over to 120 graduates locally per year, in comparison to having 30 over the last 15 years. We are aware of grant opportunities that come our way for program expansion. I think our national associations and the leaders in the community have their finger on the pulse of that. However, a lot of those grant eligibility requirements are pretty restrictive, and the grant funding support is really heavy, and we need supportive structures within institutions to be able to do that. And we've either applied and not been funded or not been eligible for such expansion grants. Right now, in the good news, what's not a barrier is the student applicant pool. So even with the increase of new programs, we're seeing a very large interested applicant pool who are well prepared in their undergrad courses, who have had a fair amount of patient care experience hours, which is a requirement for PA education. And so we have still a good applicant pool in the pipeline. One of the barriers is faculty, and for other professions that might be retirement, but in our profession, because the program in Minnesota and nationally are increasing so quickly, there is not a pool of expert faculty who have the experience in teaching to fill the needs of the new program expansions, but there's also a significant pay differential, as I imagine there are in other professions, to take a clinician and move them from clinical practice into an academic setting. In clinical placements, we've talked about that, but I had a couple other things to touch upon. This really is the rate-limiting factor for any expansion. It also could decrease enrollment in programs. Accrediting body for PAs want to see that you have sustaining clinical partners for a long period of time, up through and past graduation of your incoming cohort. And if you can't demonstrate that, you can be restricted to the amount of students that you could take. So it definitely is a gridlock that we see in terms of expanding programs. We have geographic limitations in terms of our clinical placement abilities. We have seen specifically in rural health, and this might be a contributing factor of why PAs are not practicing so much in rural areas, but we have seen a trend over the last 10 to 15 years of clinical education opportunities reduce from the rural setting. It used to be that students would have ample opportunity to train in the rural areas, and that was gridlocked in the urban areas. And then that moved into rural areas being very supportive of students who came from the rural areas or who intended to return back to practice. And right now, I don't have the data to prepare, but anecdotally, we have at least 5 out of our 24 first cohort who went into the PA profession specifically so they could care for people in their community, come from Iron Range, rural Minnesota, southwest Minnesota, whom we cannot find clinical training opportunities for them anywhere in a 100-mile radius of their home organizations. And they would like to return and care for the population of people from whom they've grown up with. And that spark, that desire for them to want to do this, is changing. They now want a network in the cities. If they can't train there, they're worried about jobs there. So it's anecdotal, but I do want to share that we do have desiring applicants and students who want to provide primary care. But if someone hasn't already, or they don't come from a rural area, providing them a training or clinical education experience in a rural area is often what they need to see what kind of practice exists in the rural community in order for them to desire to return there with their family. And a lot of the same issues that Dr. Chesney was talking about. So I guess I would encourage as a solution some focused attention from those parties that are vested about some of the solutions that could exist in these areas. I mean, from a workforce setting, we definitely also in the PA profession have the pay differential between primary care practice and specialty practice. We encourage and promote primary care practice in the educational arena, but students will go where jobs pay, and they do have a high debt load to take care of. So we do see with physicians moving into specialty practice, PAs often follow. The younger workforce in primary care in rural areas, PAs work under a supervising agreement, and they work in collaboration with physicians. And as the experience level of a physician increases, the scope of practice that they can perform increases. So isolated rural areas are more nerve-wracking to younger students who really seek the support of their physicians until they feel more confident and more experienced. The Minnesota Department of Health reported that most PAs tend to be older, citing 13% being 55 and older, and only 3% being 34 and under. So yes, the PAs are not meeting the rural health needs as we would hope and predicted they could. I think some of the solutions that we could consider are really looking at some of the legislative changes. The State Association has been really good from the inception of PA practice in Minnesota, which has been about 20 years, so we're still very young as a profession in the state. They've assisted anywhere from prescriptive practice to licensure, to current bill right now, to decrease the access issues for PA practice. I think we're really looking at how we move workforce and incentivize the students into the rural practice. There is student loan repayment options, but very few PAs have opportunity to take advantage of that. And I think most importantly is looking how we grow and support clinical education opportunities. So I have some more to present, but I think in the interest of time, I would open for Q&A, because I know you have other speakers on. I thought maybe I could be more helpful in that way.
Are there any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, can you just tell us real briefly what the difference is in between nurse practitioners and physician assistants in terms of what they can do? You know, are there things that PAs can do that APRNs can't, or vice versa? And in terms of your independence, what's the difference?
Ms. Bittiger.
Chair Huntley and Senator Liebling, I will address that from a PA perspective. It really depends on the location and specialty that a PA would practice and what they can or cannot do in a clinic. They work in collaboration with a physician and are given, delegated a scope of practice based on that time, experience in the practice, education, the trust level that has been created between that physician practice. And so PA in one setting could do one scope of practice, and a different PA in the same setting might do a separate scope of practice. And that is, so it's very fluid in that way.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Lee.
Well, let me clarify the question then. Under law, what's the maximum, if we're talking about, you know, I mean, I understand that. I'm sure that's true for APRNs, too. If they're working in an organization where they say you're going to only do this part, not this part, that's effectively going to be their scope of practice. But I mean at maximum, under the law, is there a difference?
Go ahead.
Chair Huntley and Senator Liebling, I can't speak to the advanced practice nursing in terms of what's different from by law. I only could speak with the PA perspective on we work in a delegation scope of practice with a physician, and that is unique to the PA practice, and I would not like to speak for my colleagues in that manner.
Okay. Representative Loffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I have that issue as well, and I think more importantly, the public doesn't understand either. I've kind of joked, and I hope I don't offend anyone, that we have to have health practitioner, you know, 1 to 25. And I know no one would want to be at the low level, whatever that is, whether it's 1 or it's 25. But, I mean, I think that when you're a patient, it's really confusing because you don't know who knows what, who would best answer what question, who to go. Who is this a good thing that or that I'm referred to this level of practice versus not? And I think we need to work together on not only our understanding but the public's understanding as we've evolved. And I think it's been great that we've created a broader range. But if we could, you know, actually as committee members at some point get some background on that, maybe from the Department of Health, I think that'd be helpful because at least we could try and help explain it to our constituents if we understood it.
Any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Huntley.
I will say that I had a physical exam before my cataract surgery by a physician assistant and a physician assistant student from Augsburg in Duluth.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Dr. Jeremy Springer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Springer. I'm a family physician. I practice in St. Louis Park. Today I'm here as the chair of the Minnesota Medical Association's Primary Care Physician Workforce Expansion Advisory Task Force. I won't put that down as a credential. The Minnesota Medical Association, as you know, is a professional association of about 10,000 physicians and physicians in training throughout Minnesota. I know there's been a lot of there's been presentations and more to go through yet today, so I'll try and keep it a little brief. U.S. or both the United States and Minnesota, as you know, are experiencing shortage of physicians. We all heard the numbers of estimates from the Association of American Medical Colleges of 62,000 or more, 63,000 by 2015 nationally. In Minnesota, there's estimates of around a need for an additional 1,100 or 1,200 primary care physicians by 2030, which would be a 28% increase from the number of docs that we had in primary care in 2010. There's a lot of factors that contribute to the shortage. Some of them include the aging population, as we've heard. There's also the aging of the providers and the retirement. The population itself is growing. Decreases in state funding for medical education and a steady or decreasing number of primary care physician residency slots and a declining interest in primary care careers. For example, in Minnesota's 65 and older population is expected to increase from 12% to 24% between 2000 and 2030. In addition, January 1st of 2014, thousands of Minnesotans gained access to health care coverage, and that expansion is also will make the workforce shortage a little bit more critical. The primary care physician workforce is particularly alarming for those who do live in rural Minnesota in underserved areas within the metro. These areas are already in short supply of primary care. The proposed solutions to the primary care shortage have included utilizing physician's assistants and nurse practitioners, and there is data, as we've heard, to suggest that some of them are they're subspecializing and working outside of primary care. Taking this into consideration, I think it's important that the policy solutions to relieve the shortage of primary care physicians in Minnesota don't rely strictly on increasing numbers of PAs and NPs. In January of 2030, the MMA put together the task force to explore ways to address the Minnesota primary care physician shortage, and the task force itself is composed of physicians representing state medical schools, residency programs, leadership, medical students, residents, and practicing community physicians, as well as hospital representatives. We came together to identify strategies for increasing our primary care physician workforce. As part of our task force, a summit was held last November where our objectives were to bring physicians together to discuss ways to solve the primary care physician workforce shortage and to educate physicians on the current state of the workforce shortage and to examine ways to transform physician practice in order to reinvigorate primary care. Through discussions, the task force identified several specific areas, and we've heard about some of those already today, including additional clinical training sites for medical students. There's a need to increase the number of residency slots. And as you know, they've been financially capped by the federal government since 97. There's a need to address negative perceptions of primary care among medical students, and there's a need to find ways to make primary care practice much more satisfying by changing how care is delivered and to make it financially rewarding so that primary care physicians can afford to continue to be in practice. Medical health care home may be a solution, but it's one of many that have changes that are probably needed. The task force is in the process of preparing final recommendations, which will be available in May. Expanding our primary care workforce is about more than just increasing supply. We need to reinvigorate the practice of primary care, and we need to keep physicians that we have, since we are, again, are facing the same falling off or decrease in numbers due to retirement of primary care physicians. I'm part of that baby boomer workforce, and my wife tells me I have to work till I'm 70, so we'll have another 3 years or 4 years out of me anyway. But on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association, I want to thank you for holding today's hearing and for support of the Minnesota primary care physician workforce, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Springer. And Representative Fritz, you had a question.
I do have just a question for any of them, because this is the thought that is going through my mind. In my emergency room at Faribault last year, there were 14,000 people went through the emergency room. And then I hear from constituents who can't get care, so they drive to Northfield to the Minute Clinic. So they're popping up all over. Is that a PA that's at the Minute Clinic? Who's manning those? Do you know?
Mr. Speaker and Representative Fritz, I don't work for Minute Clinic, although one of my residency mates invented it. But
good.
Dr. Douglas Smith. Anyway, Dr. Douglas Smith. Anyway, I think the Minute Clinics are staffed by various providers, and what we call the those kinds of clinics that are, whether they're in Target or the drugstore or wherever. A lot of them are staffed by PAs and NPs, but they also have physician staffing, some of them, for part of the time. And there has to be a collaborative agreement between NPs and physicians that oversee it. So there is some oversight by physicians. I think if you go to an urgent care somewhere that Park Nicollet runs or Health Partners runs or anybody else runs, you're going to have PAs in those spots, too. You'll also have physicians. You also have NPs. So.
Thank you for that answer. Now we do have urgent care back again. We just brought it back in Faribault for those folks as well. So obviously the need is there when people are driving. Actually, I've had people tell me they've driven up here to a Minute Clinic to get care because they can't get in. And so there is a definite need already for us in the rural areas.
Well, thank you, Dr. Springer. And we have to move on, but thanks for your testimony. And as you know, I've been to one of your meetings. And now we're going to hear about graduate medical education, and which is, I think, is the bottleneck for at least for primary care physicians, because the federal government sets the number of slots, and they won't allow you to increase. Mm-hmm. Well, you can do it, but they won't give you any money for it. So that's a major problem that we have. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Troy Taubenheim. I'm the director of a council of teaching hospitals in the University of Minnesota here in the metro. And with me is Dr. John Andrews, associate dean of graduate medical education from the University of Minnesota. I'm going to talk about graduate medical education, the funding of it. We'll touch on some of the stuff that you heard from some of the other presenters. I want to get through some of the basic facts of this and then, of course, try to go to some questions. Not sure we have the answers that we need, but we sure appreciate an opportunity to be here today. And I apologize if the slides are too small, and certainly, it came up earlier, we'll certainly want to make sure that these slides are provided to you directly. Can we do that? We're fortunate with graduate medical education and physician training that there's a government funding program, which has been around since the 60s, which allows the residents and fellows to be paid a stipend and employee benefits. And the funding then goes to the hospitals. And the hospitals, if the arrangement exists, like it does with the University of Minnesota, the hospitals then reimburse back to the University of Minnesota for the cost of the resident and fellow training. Medicare is the largest single payer of graduate medical education funds through their DME and their IME funding. You can see kind of an average here from CMS reimbursement, $27,000 for the direct medical education, $80,000 on average for the indirect medical education. There's a cap for both the DME and the IME, so a 1996 level. Okay, so in 1996, the Balanced Budget Act came out and said, look, we got enough physicians, we don't need any more, let's put a limit on the number of physician training slots we'll pay for through CMS. And of course, for the Merck funding, we certainly need that. I'm going to point out a few reasons here real quickly as to what that funding goes for when it comes to graduate medical education. In the Twin Cities area, teaching hospitals, and so I'll show a list of our affiliate hospitals here in just a little bit. We have approximately 1,100 training slots that get paid for by the federal government. Included in that would be the VA training slots that are paid for kind of outside of a different mechanism than the cap. We have approximately 1,300 trainees in accredited programs at any given time in the metro in our programs, which indicates that there's close to 200 of our training slots or our trainees in at any given time that aren't funded by federal funds. We had some redistributions there as well. So the first area is direct medical education to cover the direct costs, and then we have the indirect costs that go along with this. I just want to point out at the bottom of this is that the CMS portion of the direct medical education is paid as a percentage of the patient days for that hospital. All of the payments are hospital-specific based on historical cost levels, those kinds of things. So the first area I would talk about that the Merck money is used for is Merck and Medicaid funding would be to cover the direct portion of the cost, the direct costs to the hospitals for the Medicaid percentage of patient days that are there. Hopefully that makes sense. The indirect medical education is the larger amount that comes from the federal government and is used to compensate hospitals for their higher inpatient operating costs. And for some, we would just say that it costs more to take care of patients in a teaching hospital than it does in a non-teaching hospital. That's not me. That's the federal government. That's the concept behind where the IME comes from. And if you've seen the news lately, the last couple of years, the target for federal funding is to reduce the IME amounts. MMC GME organizations, as I mentioned, the public teaching hospitals in the metro, the University of Minnesota Medical School, the Family Medicine Program in the Duluth Hospitals, the Mayo Mankato Hospital and its Family Medicine Program as well. And of course, the VA, the Children's, so we get into the specialty type hospitals as well. Our trainees by category, approximately 1,300. One of the things you'll look at this is close to 50% of it falls into that primary care, above 50% if you expand that to what we call expanded primary care. So these are the numbers of our trainees that are in those categorized programs. A little breakdown, you know, kind of by the numbers specifically without the chart. This is a slide that breaks down how do we pay for the 1,276 slots that we have. 921 coming from the cap, the federal cap there. Some additional funding from CMS and HRSA for dental and podiatry, which are funded outside of the cap. The VA funding and some miscellaneous. And then the FTEs that are above our cap, okay, that the hospitals and the university are paying for, that they utilize MRC funds to cover those costs. That 187. Primary care programs. So we mentioned, you know, the primary care programs here, and I just made a listing of them. Hopefully you can see this. It's the family medicine programs at the top, the internal medicine programs in the middle, and at the bottom is the pediatrics and the med-peds program at the university. These numbers represent the size of the program per year, so it would be representative of the graduates that we have on an annual basis. To carry this further, our data that we track in our system for the graduates that came out of these primary care programs in 2013 academic year, so from 7/1/12 to 6/30/13, 68 family medicine graduates, 8 went on to specialty training, 42 went into local practices in the 5-state region, 15 of which were in rural communities, and 18 went outside of the 5-state region. So we don't retain them all, but we retain some, and that's key there. Internal medicine, 61 graduates. One of the things with that is they train in a primary care program, but 27 of those 61 graduates went on to specialty care, and then 29 local practices, none of which were rural, and 5 went into practice outside the 5-state region. I would not say that the 29 that went into local area practices were primary care. Some of those would be categorized, a lot of them would be categorized as hospitalists, which a lot of people will not identify as primary care. Pediatrics, similar numbers. You can see that on 34 graduates in pediatrics. I want to talk just briefly about the physician workforce. One of the things we've been doing in the last couple of years is pulling the licensure data, barreling it down to active physicians under the age of 75 that claim that their practice location is in Minnesota. 43% of those out of the 13,000 are age 56 or above. Certainly, I'm not saying that age 56 and above are not productive, but in the next 10 years, we'll reach retirement age, depending on how you define retirement age. As Dr. Springer indicated, that's maybe more like 70 than 65. But the point is that we have more physicians in the 50s and 60s than what we have that are in their 30s and 40s. Fact of our population. The next thing I would look at, and I barreled this down by primary care specifically, is that we have the number of physicians in our active base of 39% of them being in primary care specialty. 43%, the same percentage of those in primary care are age 56 or older. The average reaching age 65 in the next 10 years, 190. We just showed the graduation data from our database. As being 75 of the graduates in primary care programs were retained in the state. So there's our fact that I would say is I'm not going to go on record to say that we're how many physicians we're going to need 10 years from now, but what I will say is that if we don't do something about the supply side, we're not going to have enough to say that we have as many physicians 10 years from now as we do today. In addition to the programs that are managed by the MMC GME organization, there is the training programs in Rochester through Mayo, and I just would say that we do not work with those programs directly. but certainly a significant amount of training happens in Rochester with the training programs, about 1,000 accredited slots in Rochester. Their caps, similarly, would be much less, maybe even in the 500 range. And certainly, that population of residents and physicians in Rochester, added to what we have in the rest of the state, make Minnesota a strong physician state and a strong ranking physician state in terms of residency positions per population. The next few slides, The next few slides here talk about the number of medical students that are trying to get into our residency programs. And this slide particularly talks about the fact that there's 26,000 ACGME first-year slots, and we had 34,000 applicants by the categories identified. So USMD graduates, USDO graduates, previous USMD graduates that didn't get in the year before for whatever reason, international graduates that are U.S. citizens, and international foreign graduates coming in. And those that didn't get in are to the side of that. The projections of the number of medical students graduating from U.S. schools in 2016 is going to be 27,000. The residency slots are not going to increase very much because of that cap that's there. I will say that I went back after I got here 10 years ago. We pretty much had the same number of physicians in training that we do today. We've not been able to grow our slots. It hasn't happened with those slots. So the bottleneck for training more physicians is in the residency slots that we have to offer, as Dr. Springer and others have said. Funding threats are coming. Mr. Chair, I'm going to stop with that and let Dr. Andrews make some observations and then maybe go to questions if that's okay.
That's fine. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Andrews.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is John Andrews. As Troy mentioned, I'm the Associate Dean for Graduate Medical Education at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a primary care pediatrician in the community. And in the interest of time, I'll just make one comment and try to synthesize what Troy said, because I know you're concerned with the primary care physician workforce. And the thing that I think is important to recognize is that the funding to support graduate medical education flows to hospitals, and hospitals are not a good place to train primary care physicians. Thank you.
I would say, yeah, the funding is based on the amount of time they spend in the hospital. And primary care docs are supposed to spend most of their time in the clinic, which is a big change from the way medicine used to be taught 30 years ago. Question, Representative McConnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for perhaps you, Mr. Chairman, regarding the some of the programs that we have that encourage the physicians, once they're finished their residency, to stay in the state. I know there are some programs that we have, but I'm wondering if you can expand on that regarding...
Well, the there's two ways to do that. One is the loan forgiveness if they stay in the state in primary care, particularly if they go into rural areas. They get some of their loans paid off, partly by the state, which is a big incentive, since most you can have, but most physicians are graduating from medical school about $150,000 in debt. So that's a big incentive for them to go into a specialty that might pay $600,000 a year instead of what the primary care doc gets paid, someplace between $175,000 and $200,000 a year. I think that the main thing we have is the loan forgiveness program. Other than recruiting, who you let into med school is you can. I used to be head of the admissions committee at the UMD Medical School, and we're very careful about who we will admit, and we're looking for people that we think will stay in Minnesota, particularly at UMD in a rural area. Sort of as a joke, I would say, I used to kid the other members of the admissions committee that we should not be interviewing the applicant, we should be interviewing the applicant's spouse, because that's a very important issue, and if the the applicant's from Black Duck, Minnesota, and his or her spouse is from Edina, they're probably not going to go back to Black Duck.
They probably won't stay together either.
Representative Gow.
Yeah, I was familiar with that project, that program. I had a constituent that the program was being pulled, or some of it was being pulled back, the loan forgiveness, and Representative Garofalo had a bill last session to deal with just a certain number of doctors, one included in my district. But really, other than in the admissions and then at that loan forgiveness, so there are only really two programs that we have to encourage people to stay in our state.
Representative Dean, who knows a lot about this issue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the work that you have done with trying to keep physicians in Minnesota, and particularly in rural Minnesota, with UMD's program, which I've learned a little bit about over the years, the RPAP program, and has been very successful in trying to keep physicians in greater Minnesota. And one of I had two questions, of both of which we can get afterwards. And I assume we have a report that we make the Department of Health do on our residency slots, or on how they're filling and in what areas, how many applicants per slot. How are we doing that? I was just interested in if somebody knows the answer to that, if they can email me that, because I don't remember ever having to look at that. Mm-hmm. And then
Mark Schoenbaum has all that data, I believe.
And just if you can email me that, if that's a report, I'm assuming that we make you guys do that every year. If I could just get emailed that of how we're doing with our slots, particularly not just in primary care, but across the spectrum within the University of Minnesota's competitiveness with other states. And the other thing that I think that I would encourage people within the department to look at is not just licensed physicians and how we're attracting them and retaining them, but where they're practicing and how. I know several physicians that are not practicing either at all or at what would be considered full time, because they've made the decision between money and stress and lots of other things that it's not worth it or they can't do it. We all have this preconception of a Marcus Welby who goes to the practice every day and until he's 74, delivers a baby in the morning and dies that afternoon with no retirement at all. What we have today is people making lifestyle decisions in their 40s and 50s. I keep thinking in my head of a gentleman that Minnesota attracted top of his class, got into medicine, and went through a residency program, did everything correctly, kept him in Minnesota, practiced in Minnesota, but is not going to practice for the second half of his career just because it's not worth it anymore in Minnesota. And I think that's a shame. I wouldn't show up on any report, probably still licensed, but I'm wondering how we're measuring that loss at the second half of practice for people that we've really invested a lot of money in the state of Minnesota.
Do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, I do not have an answer to that, but that's a good question. If we can find that data, we'll do some looking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean Mark Schoenbaugen, we do survey physicians and ask them about their work locations and activities and how they spend their time, and we'll be happy to get you that data. I'm not sure it drills down precisely to your question, but we do have something that will get a little bit close.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Representative Newton.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Do other states recruit our doctors and pay incentives, such as paying off their school bills and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. We're not substantially different than other states in that regard, and to my knowledge, there aren't significant incentives being provided by other states to recruit our physicians away. The lifestyle and personal choices of our graduates are far more influential than any state programs.
I would also say that they tend to go, they tend to stay where they do their residencies, and if they can't get into a Minnesota residency, they're going to some other state, and they tend to stay there. So that's another problem that we have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, a comment about that. You're absolutely right that there is a large influence of the place that you train on where you ultimately choose to practice. And so physicians who train in Minnesota do tend to stay in Minnesota. It's also the case, and I think this point has been made earlier, that the thing that most influences whether someone returns to practice in an underserved rural area is whether they're from that area in the first place. And so the graduates of our programs who've recently gone back to practice in greater Minnesota in rural areas have done so because it was a lifelong dream of theirs to practice medicine in the community where they grew up, and that's the most influential thing for them.
I can give you two examples of that. At the UMD Med School, there's he was in our second class, and he's practices in Crosby, and his son now also practices in Crosby. But Crosby is an unusual place because the docs can say, well, "Wait a minute, you mean I can live by a lake and also practice good medicine?" Crosby has a very nice lake right in town. So, any other questions? Okay, yeah, Mr. McDonald, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will move the minutes.
Okay, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. And thank you, Dr. Andrews and Mr. Taubenheim, for your presentation.
Thank you.
Sorry we got pushed up at the end, but it was a very informative meeting. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.